So I want you to think about the number one issue in your life and in basically everybody's life as they're a kid. What's the hardest lesson to learn? The hardest issue to grasp as a child is what I came up with is learning submission to authority. The hardest thing in life for me and for my kids, as I'm teaching, you know, 5 years, 4 years old, the hardest thing for them to grasp is the issue of hierarchy, submitting to hierarchy. When you're a kid, you have teachers that tell you that you need to listen to them, you need to obey them. You have parents that say that you need to obey them. You have police officers. You've got, you know, as a kid, you've got a lot of these figures that you are supposed to listen to and obey and submit to. And it doesn't change as we grow up, does it? We have college professors. If you're in the military, you have those who are superior to you that usually have the right to tell you what to do, and you kind of have to do it. You have the legal system that is put into place that we have to abide by the rules or we have to pay the consequences. There's authority all around us in the government, in the family situation where the parents are in charge of the kids. You've got church structure, you've got legal structure. There's all these different structures where there's authority and somebody has to be in charge and somebody has to be the one that submits. This is kind of the hardest issue to understand as a child and probably one of the hardest to learn as an adult, that you have to just kind of come to grips with the fact that you've got to submit at several different levels in your life. And that comes with all of us. Let's open up our Bibles to the 11th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And we're just going to go through verse 2 through verse 16. So let's just start with verse 2. The biggest issue that we're going to face today in this text, might be surprising to you, is not the head covering. It's submission to authority. Verse 2, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2. I praise you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions just as I passed them on to you. Traditions. These are traditions that Paul gives us. Paul is commending them for remembering the Corinthians at this time. He's commending them for remembering these things. And you remember when we did the breaking of bread, there was something else in later in this chapter. I think it's verse 17. Now, in giving the following instructions, I do not praise you. Okay, the same chapter, there's one part that he praises them over, and there's one part that he doesn't praise them over. Okay, he commends them on this section that we're going into. In the section that we covered a couple of studies ago, the breaking of bread, he didn't commend what they were doing. It's important to note that this is something that they are doing right. Okay, so this is something that they were doing right. And I'm guessing that in the context of this, there was questions that came over it. Like, we're doing this, we're practicing it, this particular thing, but we don't know why we're doing it really. Or maybe we're not sure exactly what's going on. So we want you to clarify this. So Paul's going to clarify in this section. So what does the word tradition mean? It's important that you realize that they're kind of like instructions that are handed down. Traditions are things that are handed down. And there are really two aspects of traditions. One of them is a good tradition, and one of them is a bad tradition. And bad traditions are ones that maybe are man-made, that they kind of say, well, you have to do this because, and they kind of justify it with their own understanding. And that's what the Pharisees were doing. The Pharisees would say, well, you can't do anything on the Sabbath. You can't do X, Y, and Z. And they would list out all of these traditions that were not really from God. They were just kind of made up, like they would read the actual law given by God and then come to a conclusion and then come to another conclusion based on the conclusion and then come to another conclusion based on the conclusion that was based on the conclusion. And they'd end up getting all of these weird laws that they were, traditions that they were passing down that were not really in the nature of the original law that God had given. So you've got the Pharisees who gave not very good traditions that are man-made, the ones that we kind of think, oh, we got to get rid of that tradition. We don't need those traditions. And then you've got good traditions, which are the ones that are divinely originated, the ones that came from God. So then Paul goes on to talk about this tradition. So we're going to start in verse 3 now. But I want you to know that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Okay, so we've got a hierarchy here. It's kind of not in the order that I would have written it in, because I think of things in order. First A, then B, then C, then D, but he kind of did it in a different structure, a different organization. So headship is what we're going to talk about in this verse. I want you to know, he says, verse 3, I want you to know, and we're going to stop there for a second. This is something that Paul is trying to make clear. It's not saying this is a mystery, I'm going to try to confuse you, I'm going to try to pull the wool over your eyes, this is something that's way too heavy for you guys to understand. This is something that he wants us to know. He wants us to understand. And the point of him writing this wasn't to fog us over, but it was so that he could clear up the questions that they had at the time. Okay, I want you to know. It's not complicated. This is easy. Just read it for what it says, okay? Headship is the main point of this message. There are two meanings to the word head. And we've talked about this when we went through Ephesians, when it talked about the head of the body is Christ, right? And it's not necessarily that he's the one that makes all the decisions and he's the one that leads, but he's also the one that kind of gives the senses to the body. It can smell, it can taste, it can hear, it can see, you can feel. So all five senses are wrapped up in your head, right? You can feel maybe better out of your fingers, but all of the five senses you can see in you can use in your head. So one of the meanings of the word head that is used in this text is the place where your brain is held, right? This is your head on top of your body. The other meaning of the word head is that it is something, it is a being of high status. When you say the head of a company, the head of the military, the head of the government, you kind of know what I'm saying, right? When I say the head of the government is Obama, right? Everybody kind of gets a sense of he's not a physical brain and skull that sits on top of a body. No. When Paul uses the word head, this is what he's saying. Yeah. You're in charge. Exactly. And you could say who's the head of the UN? It used to be Kofi Annan. I don't know who it is anymore. But you could use the word head in that context, and everybody kind of knows what you're saying. Well, this is what Paul is saying. There's two different meanings of the word head, and he's going to use both in this text that we're talking about. So when he says that God is the head of Christ, that means that God is kind of in charge of Christ. Christ is to submit to God. And if you look at the life of Christ, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, you see that pretty much every step he took was in submission to the Father. Even, you know, take this cup from me. I don't want to do this. This isn't what I want to do. This isn't my will, but yours. You know, and at every moment of Christ's life, he says, I'm submitting to you. I might not want to, but I'm going to submit. Okay, so we see that God is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of man, which means that we as men should be responding to Christ's leadership. And then we see man as the head of woman. Now, one of the biggest issues that come up with this, I'm not even going to talk about, I'm talking about headship right now, verse 3. This verse has been basically labeled as being sexist, awful, cultural, not good, horrible, you know, in all sorts of ridiculous names and all this kind of stuff about this text. But the point of it is that if you don't understand this, the rest of it isn't going to make any sense. The rest of chapter 11, verse 16, isn't going to make any sense. So if you don't understand the headship, then you probably, or if you don't agree with it, it's one thing to not understand it, but if you don't agree with it, then the rest of it is going to be just kind of boring for you to listen to this, because it doesn't make any lick of sense. If you don't understand the headship between God and Christ, this is part of the Trinity. This relationship that God and Christ has is that it's part of the Trinity. Is that relationship that they had, was it cultural or was it eternal? Eternal. Okay. Now, one quote here, I have it. A lot of you know who Alex Strock is. He's kind of the writer of the Brethren movement right now. I don't know. He's not even just Brethren. He's kind of transcended into the broader Christian realm. He wrote the book Biblical Eldership and Biblical Deacon. He wrote a bunch of books that have kind of become pretty well-sold books. Anyway, I was listening to a message from him on this, and he says, we are questioning the Trinity itself if we say that this is a cultural matter. If you think that this is a cultural matter, the whole relationship of the Trinity is probably in question. If you think that the headship is cultural, then you probably have a problem with the Trinity itself. Because the relationship between God the Father and Jesus Christ is that of leader, like authority, and submission. One's in charge, one submits. Is one more important than the other? No, absolutely not. Is the Trinity lopsided? Is one more equal than, or one more, you know, important than the other? Absolutely not. The point is not of equality. It's of different roles and different purpose. We are questioning the Trinity itself if we say that this is a cultural matter. That was Alex Strock. We will see that Paul doesn't use any cultural arguments within his teaching. If you do not believe verse 3, then everything else that follows is pointless. If you have a problem with the hierarchy of headship, there's not much that I can tell you about the next few verses, because that's kind of laying the foundation. And if you have questions about that, it's great. Probably right now is not a good time to ask, but at some point maybe we could go through it. But this is what he's saying. God is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of man. Man is the head of woman. Now I want to talk to men for a second here. Within the teaching of headship, we need to understand that we are to be the head of woman just like Christ is our head. How does Christ treat you? How does he treat me? How does Christ lead me? Patiently, in love. This should be the way that we lead, the way that we treat those who we're entrusted with by God to lead. Our children, our wives, we are to lead them in love, just like Christ is leading us. Now, there's a lot of things that you could say, you know, abuse and horrible travesties have been basically justified by this scripture. That's not what I'm saying, and that's not what Paul's saying. If you're abusing your wife, do you think that Christ has ever abused you? No. Christ has never done anything that would be even close to considered abuse to any of us men. It's exactly the opposite. So if you use this out of context and you'd use it to justify abuse, how dare you? That's awful, because that is not what it's saying. So I'm going to get that out of the way. Christ does not boss you around. Christ does not abuse you. So don't do it to those who God has given you under you to lead. Now, women, notice that the man has a head, and that also Christ has a head. So the fact that you might be submitting to man, understand that man is submitting to someone as well. And that person that man is submitting to is also submitting to someone else. The only one who doesn't have to submit is God the Father, because he's the only one that's a leader that doesn't submit. Realize that you're not the only one who's asked to submit here. We see all throughout Christ's life that the Father would lead and the Son would obey, especially in the book of John. If you go through the whole book of John, he's like, you know, I don't buy off on all this stuff, but I'm going to do it anyway, because I don't want to do it, but I'm going to do it because I have to submit to the Father. Jesus was submissive to the Father, but that doesn't make him inferior. In fact, he was just as necessary in the act of restoration and salvation as the Father is. Different function, but not inferior. And this is the same thing that we see with men and women. Alex Strock wrote the book Equal Yet Different. And it's based, and I would encourage you guys to read it. It's really short, has nothing to do with head coverings, has to do with men and women just in general. And it's a really short book, maybe 100 pages. If you have any questions about the roles of men and women, and I'm not talking about in the workplace or in the politics or anything else, I'm talking about in your home, the structure in the home and in the church, it would be worth reading that, because it basically covers the whole issue. We are not saying that one person is above anybody else as far as rank or worth. We're all worth Christ dying for us. We're all worth it. Men, women, children, adults, old people, young people, in every race, we're all worth it. Okay, let's move on to verse 4. So verse 3 lays out the foundation. Verse 4, any man who prays or prophesies with his head covered disgraces his head. This is where Paul breaks with Jewish tradition. Now, a lot of people say, oh, well, this is cultural of the time. This is a custom of the time. I was hoping that that would be the case, sort of, because then it would add a lot more, it would be a lot easier to get up here and say, this is all cultural, folks. Let's have a burning out in the, you know, parking lot. This would be a lot easier, and we'd have a lot less explaining to do. But Paul broke with Jewish tradition. What was the Jewish tradition? Men had to wear a covering. Well, now they're wearing yarmulkes, those little things here, right? That's Jewish tradition. That's what Paul was raised in. He was trained in this. This is not the culture of the day anywhere. The fact that men are supposed to take off their hats or their head covering. That was not practiced anywhere. Paul was a Jew. He knew the Old Testament. And he knew that the priests of the Old Testament had to have their heads covered. He also knew that the Roman men would pull their togas. They found artwork. And when Roman men were doing religious ceremonies in their culture, in their religion, not in Christianity, but when the Roman men did their prayer and burning incense and that kind of stuff, they pulled their toga over. There's artwork showing that when they were bowing and doing and burning stuff, they would have their toga pulled over. Okay? So this is not, this idea of men taking their hats off is totally different than anything else in this whole period that we're looking at. So to say that it's a cultural thing is ridiculous, because it's totally different than anything we've ever heard. Now, I'm not talking about in America today, because everybody takes their hats off. You hear the ball game, everybody's, you know, when they're doing the Pledge of Allegiance and the national anthem, that kind of stuff. That's pretty well ingrained into our tradition at this point. But at the time that this was written, this was practiced by nobody. It was extremely Christian in origin. There was no Old Testament. There was no culture. It was very against culture for men to take their hats off. So the first thing I want to get across, and I wish I had an outline for you guys to fill in the blanks, but I just figured that there's too much information here. But the idea of men uncovering their heads was a completely new tradition. Let's go to 5 and 6, verse 5 and 6. But any woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered disgraces her head, for it is one and the same thing as having a shaved head. For if a woman will not cover her head, she should cut off her hair. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, she should cover her head. 5 and 6. The men and women in this text are doing the exact same thing. What are the two things that they're doing? Praying or prophesying. These are not things that are totally different. Maybe this is going to be a shock to our little congregation here, but they're doing the exact same thing. They're both permitted to pray. They're both permitted to prophesy. And we'll talk about what prophecy means here in a minute. But in this context, both of them are doing the same thing. And while they're doing the same thing, they're called to do it with two different forms of arrangement on their ornamentation on their head. One is called not to, and one is called to have some. But they're basically doing the same thing, praying and prophesying. Within these acts, the men are called to uncover, and the women are called to cover. This is Paul's point here. It is understandable. It's not difficult to understand. He says in verse 2, he says, I want to make this clear. Verse 3, but I want you to know. These are not hard to understand. So when should we do this? We've got the Amish and the Mennonites who think that we should do this all the time, although their men wear hats, straw hats, so I don't know if that, but their women wear theirs all the time. We've got other countries who are, you know, other people who say never, this is cultural. So here, my question for you, and I'm not going to answer it for you, but I'm going to give you my opinion. So my question is, when should we do this act? Does it have to happen all the time, or does it have to happen occasionally, or does it never have to happen? It says when you're praying or prophesying. Now, if you take that literal, then it would mean every time you pray or prophesy. When you read it, like I read it, which is within the broader context of the book, you notice that the next part of this chapter, we're talking about breaking of bread. Most of this book was written to the church. It wasn't written to individual lifestyles. It was written to how to behave within the context of the church. I read somewhere that it's like 80% of this book is corporate worship stuff, corporate gathering stuff. Discipline within the church, which is chapter 5. You've got breaking of bread, chapter 11. You've got all of the spiritual gifts in 12 and 14. You've got all of this stuff that has to do with governing within the church. It doesn't really have to do with practical living outside the church, per se. So maybe this is overly simplifying this, but in my logic and my reasoning, which isn't necessarily thus saith the Lord, is that this is talking about within the context of the church meetings. And I have no problem with the Mennonites and the Amish who do it all the time, or those who decide not to do it at all. That's up, you know, it's up to, it's a personal thing. But basically, it doesn't say that you have to do it all the time. But if you think that way, that's cool. Go ahead. And it doesn't say not to do it. But if you think that way too, go ahead. It's a symbol. It's not gonna. Like my wife says, as long as you verify and make sure that, or proclaim that it has no bearing on your salvation whatsoever. It's just like getting baptized, dunked in the water back here. It has no bearing on your salvation. Breaking bread has no bearing on your salvation. The head covering has no bearing on your salvation. It's a symbol. Okay, so back to the praying and prophesying. One is the act of speaking to God, and the other is the act of speaking for God or from God. Does the prayer have to be audible? I would say that when another guy is praying, I generally take my hat off. I'm praying with him. Maybe he's leading us in prayer, maybe he's leading me in prayer, but I tend to be praying with him. So the prayer doesn't have to be audible. It's while you're praying. Someone else could be doing the audible part, but you are praying with them silently. Now prophecy, and this is an interesting one. The Greek lexicon gave us three or four different types of prophecy. So proclaiming an inspired revelation is the first one. Tell something that is hidden from the view or hidden from view or revealing something. And the third one is foretelling something that lies in the future. Okay, so there's three types of prophecy. One that's speaking from God, that's just teaching from God, and that's proclaiming an inspired revelation, like what I'm doing right now. I'm telling you about something that's already inspired revelation. Then part two, the second one is telling something that's hidden from view, like what Paul was doing. Paul was writing this. Nobody had any idea what was going on before that, but Paul, like the mystery that Paul proclaimed, right, which was the church, that would be considered telling something that was hidden from view or to reveal something. And the last one is to foretell something that lies in the future. That's kind of what we think of as prophesying. We think of something that's going to happen in the future, but that's just one of the definitions. If the woman doesn't cover her head in verse 5 and 6, her head, she is shaming her head. Now, this is where it gets a little touchy. It gets a little bit sticky. Is she talking about her head, where her brain is, and her hair and ears and nose? Or is she talking about her head as in the one that's above her, which is her husband? Or her head meaning, I believe that it could be either one. Because there's two different types of head and it isn't very clear. I would say probably, if I had to guess, like Val's saying, I probably would say her head as in her husband. And if you're dishonoring, if it's dishonoring your head, I would imagine that means husband, and which means that you're pretty much disagreeing with the whole flow of the structure of the whole hierarchy that God has put in place. Which means if you're disrespecting your head, you're probably disrespecting his head, and you're disrespecting his head, which means God, the Father, the Son, and the man. In any case, it's her not showing subordinates to the authority over her, is what Paul is saying. The other part that he brings up has to do with the hair. I think this is, again, not thus saith the Lord, this is what I say. I think what Paul is saying here is that if you're going to act like a man, and if you're a woman and you're going to act like a man, shave your head, act like a man. Cut your hair like a man, look like a man, why not be a man? Because that's ultimately, if it's a symbol of who you are in Christ and you can't accept that, then be a man. Shave your head. I think that it was so outlandish when he said that, it was almost a joke when he said it. Then just shave your head. I don't think he meant it literally, because that'd be ridiculous. I think he's saying that to kind of exaggerate his point. It's, you know, in verse 5, but any woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered disgraces her head, for it is one and the same thing as having a shaved head. For if a woman will not cover her head, she should cut off her hair. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, she should cover her head. Now, this is going to open up a can of worms, but you can kind of tell men and women naturally by their hairstyle, right? I mean, it's better than judging from the other parts of the body, right? Because that has a sexual nature. So if you're judging someone by the way that they look, if they're a man or a woman, one of the most obvious ways is to look at their hair. Now, we have examples, and this is all generalities. We've had cancer survivors that have no hair. Okay, that's, you're right, you got me there. Okay, this is generalities, right? But generally speaking, you could look at someone and go, yeah, I think Van's a guy, I think Val's a guy, I think that they're sitting next to women because of their hair. Yeah, well, he's got facial hair, so it kind of makes up for it. But you can generally tell with, you know, I can kind of tell who's a girl and who's a guy without scaling the body, right? You can kind of just look at the hair. One way of telling, okay? If you see a woman who has very short hair, you think she's a cancer survivor or she has an alternative lifestyle. That might be an overgrossly overgeneralization of my opinion, but usually when you see a gal that's buzzed hair, or that, you know, you think that she could possibly have an alternative lifestyle, sexual orientation, you know, and that's just a natural gut reaction. I don't know if it's the same for you, but that's just what I see when I see someone like that. Or I think cancer survivor or something, you know, something to the effect of there might be have been some medical issue. At any rate, if a woman doesn't cover her head, she is shaming her head. She is not showing her subordination. And Paul is, and what I imagine is Paul is saying that it's manlike and unnatural. It's unwomanly to not have long hair. This is what Paul is saying. Paul really shows his emotion and frustration, on, like I said in verse 6, when he says, then just cut the whole thing off. Right? I don't think he was saying that literally. I think he was saying it as an absurd statement to make his point. Okay, so let's go ahead and go to verse 7. I can tell this is a real popular subject here. For a man should not have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. This would back up what Val said about when you look at that she's dishonoring something, it would probably be the man, because the man is, she is the glory of man. So verse 7, Paul reaffirms the point that men are to reflect God in this verse. And if you think about what attributes that God gave men that kind of represent God, I came up with a short list. Generally speaking, men are stronger. They have a more authority in their stature. They're usually a little bigger. These are, you know, there are women that are tall. So I'm not saying this as a rule. But I'm saying, generally speaking, men have more strength. They're taller. The stature is bigger. Men's voices are usually deeper. I was going to make a crack about this because Andrea actually has a lower voice than me, but she's not here. But generally speaking, men have lower voices, usually. Okay, these are all kind of generalizations. But these are kind of things that speak of authority. When you think of God's voice in the movies, they always have a low voice and it's echoey, right? And generally speaking, the attributes of authority we see in men. Not always. I mean, there were women leaders in the Old Testament because the men were too pathetic, I guess, to do the job. But generally speaking, these are obviously generalizations. But basically, man is to reflect God. Woman is the glory of man, Paul says. Why was woman created? This is an interesting concept. Adam was very lonely. He kind of goes through the Garden of Eden here in a few minutes in this chapter, or the creation account. If you think about the creation, before Eve came about and it was just Adam, he probably was strong and he probably was pretty handsome. You know, he probably was fit. He could probably do a lot of work, and he was probably a good-looking guy. But he was lonely. He didn't, you know, he didn't have any companionship with someone that was like him, but not exactly him. And so what did God do? God gave him the woman. And he had a companion and a helpmate. So the story kind of goes like this. Adam was probably, you know, good-looking and doing fine, but then when we see Eve, we think, whoa. She's really good looking, right? Whoa, man. Yeah, that's the story. Whoa, man. When you imagine Eve coming into the world, you think, holy crimey, she's really good looking. And that Adam guy, he was good looking before, but she's really good looking. You know, he was, you know, buff and could do a lot of work and was, but she's beautiful, right? You really see God's beauty in the creation, I think, through women. So if woman was made out of the man's rib, you know, we all know the story of Genesis, right? A woman was made for man, I would say for our enjoyment, because dang, you know, they're really good looking. And men are not generally that good looking. Another generalization. So when you think about the glory of men, men take glory in their wives. The other story I was going to say is when you think about a husband and a wife, right? When you know the husband, you're like, oh yeah, that's so and so. I work with him, or I know him from such and such. But when you meet his wife, that elevates your view of him, doesn't it? Oh, his wife. He really married up. People, I have a story about Andrea. When I was out at camp, this gal, we were engaged, I think, and yeah, or something. We might have just been married or something. And we were out at camp, and this gal that I have known my entire life, we went out to camp together. We knew each other. I can't remember where she goes now, but she goes used to go to one of the sister assemblies, and she said, "Wait, that's your wife?" And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Wow. You know, does she have glasses? Did she not see you?" You know, and so women generally make you look better, don't they, men? When you have your wife or your fiance or your girlfriend, whatever, they generally make you look better. When Paul says woman is the glory of man, he's right. I take utter glory in my wife and my two daughters. They make me look really good. Look at those two beautiful girls, you know? Wow. How was I so lucky? My son, you know, yeah, but my daughters, they're beautiful. You know, when you think of glory, what you glory in, men, is your wife and your daughters, right? It's true. So when Paul says, woman is the glory of man, I think that's what he means. Okay, so then he goes into Adam and Eve, verse 8 through 10. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for the sake of woman, but woman for man. For this reason, a woman should have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Okay? And we'll get into the angels part here for a minute. But it's for this reason, he says in verse 10. For this reason, a woman should have a symbol of authority on her head. Okay? For this reason. This is the reason why Paul says for women to wear a head covering, and men to not wear one. Is there anything cultural in this reason yet? We have Adam and Eve. We have the Trinity mentioned, the hierarchy within the Trinity. I don't see anything cultural yet. We'll get into the cultural argument here in a minute. The creation account in Genesis is not cultural. That's natural eternity we're talking, or at least eternity for this world, nature, I should say. The word symbol that is used here in verse 10, for this reason, a woman should have a symbol of authority on her head, means that it represents the submitting to authority that God has put over her. And that sounds really harsh, but in a way, I'm hoping that I can make this sound better than it sounds. The actual head covering is not the point. So if you're worried about the head covering being the point, it's not the point. The point is the submission to your husband or to the men that God has put in your life, meaning fathers. I don't see any younger girls here, but if you have a father in your life that you're under his roof, then you're under his submission, or your mother's if your father is gone. The idea here is submission. The head covering is not the point. Just like water baptism just gets you wet. It's not the point. It's the inward spiritual baptism that we talked about last week. The breaking of bread isn't really the point. We can all break bread at our own by ourselves. It's remembering what it symbolizes that's the point. The head covering is not the point. It's your submission to where God has put you that's the point. By wearing something on your head, women, a woman shows that she accepts and loves who God has made her to be. And I'll take this time right now to say, there isn't an explicit definition of what to wear. It doesn't say it has to be a mantilla, it has to be a hat, it has to be a shawl, it has to be a doily, it has to be... It could be whatever you want. The idea is that it's a symbol. If it's a hat, let it be a hat. If it's a mantilla, let it be a mantilla. I think that's the cultural part, is to figure out, you know, when this church started, I have pictures that just show hats. They just wore little hats. If that's what's in style, go ahead and wear a hat. In the South, most of the time, you see the big flower hats, you know, that it was funny, when you watch movies, you notice these things. We watched a movie a couple of nights ago called A Man Called Peter, from 1955 or something, 57, something like that. And all of the women wore hats in the church. It was just like, and I'm toned into it because I'm studying, right? And I'm thinking, oh, all the women have hats. Must have been in style back then. It must have been of the period. And so to get back to the point, what you wear is trivial as long as it's visible, because it says a sign upon your head. So as long as it's visible, I don't think it really matters what it is. Okay, verse 10, because of the angels. I remember at the end of the last part of verse 10, it says, I don't know if you guys remember, most of you won't remember Ralph Morris. There might be a few of you. He was one of the founding members with my grandparents that started the church about 500 years ago or something. And he had a really interesting, kind of twisted sense of humor. A great, very godly man. I sat down with him one time when he was a couple of years before he died, and we sat down and I said, so what are you going to teach me today? You know, I was a teenager. What are you going to tell me today, Ralph? I kind of considered him my grandpa, you know, one of my grandpas kind of. I said, what are we going to learn today? And he goes, what do you think about angels? I don't know. I haven't really thought much about them. And he goes, are angels cultural? What do you mean? Were angels just around back in the New Testament or the Old Testament or the end times? Are they around in this dispensation? He might not have used that word. But he said, are they around today in America? And I said, as far as I know, I think angels are around. And he says, well, because some woman at church was trying to tell me that they were cultural. And he said, he brought up this point where it says in verse 10, for this reason, a woman should have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Angels, that's another reason why to wear one that doesn't seem to be cultural. And we read in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 12, that angels actually watch us. We minister to them. They look down on the church. And we teach through our behaviors. That was the one factor. Okay, what was the one thing that Satan fell over? What was the one thing that... Satan was an angel, for those of you who don't know. At least that's what we come together. Satan at one point was an angel. What was the one factor? What was the thing that made him stumble to be a fallen angel? He wanted to be in control. He wanted to be like God and have power. He couldn't accept submitting to God. So if Paul's saying because of the angels, and now this isn't explicitly mentioned in this text. I'm just pulling in other texts that could make it, it could be the what he's trying to say. Because a lot of the commentators say, he's not really clear, it could be this, it could be that, it could be that. But if you look at what led Satan to fall, it was this very issue. He could not to submit to God's authority. So if we're ministering to angels by taking our hats off or putting our hats on, whatever gender you are, that could be ministering to an angel that's considering doing the same thing Satan did, because it's not unprecedented. Angels have done it in the past. Satan did. Satan is a fallen angel. And if we want to minister to angels, which is what we're called to do in 1 Peter, and here we see that they're watching us, we are to submit to God. And one of the other points that somebody brought up was that angels don't know what's in your heart. Andrea says, you know, like with baptism, with the breaking of bread, it's really what's in your heart, right? Well, of course it is. That's what matters. But the problem here is that angels don't see what's in your heart. They see what's outside, not what's inside. That's one of the reasons why Paul says you need to have that symbol visible. People have to see it. Angels have to see it because they're watching us. They're probably watching us right now. We're ministering to them. They're not cultural. They are going today. They're a thing for today. Verse 11 and 12. In any case, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For just as woman came from man, we go back to creation, so man comes through woman. But all things come from God. This is the most leveling part of this whole thing. Nobody's above anybody else of importance or worth. Everybody. Do you think we could even have salvation without Christ? So would you say that Christ is inferior because he had to submit? No. In fact, if anything, he taught us that humility, humbleness, is superior right? So this is the level playing ground that Paul's trying to give us. Women and men depend on each other for procreation. Men, if you think that you're high and mighty and that you're that much more powerful than your wife, okay, great. Think about coming into the world without your mom. Would you be here without a woman giving birth to you? No. And vice versa. Women, you got to have a dad, at least a certain point. You know, he had to be there in order for you to be conceived. In the original, Eve came from Adam. But now, we all come from women, and with the dad being involved, okay? The idea is that nobody's more important than anybody else. We're all important. We're all equal. We're all worth a lot to God. Nobody's better than anybody else. Verse 13. Judge for yourself. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Now, this is, from what I understand from the text and from all of the people that I've read, this is not a question that needs to be pulled out of context. It is a question that is asking within the context of his argument. It's a rhetorical question. If I just went through and gave you this whole explanation of something, and then I'd say, doesn't that make sense? That's what Paul is doing. Paul gave you a huge explanation of why women should wear head covering and man shouldn't. And he's saying, now, doesn't that make sense? Are you confused by this? He's not asking you to pull this one verse out of context and say, now, you in 2013 in Gresham, Oregon, do you think that that makes sense? That's not what he's saying. He's saying within the context, he's actually using this as a rhetorical part of his argument. It's a persuasive question. He just got done talking about nature, which is Adam and Eve, the creation. That's nature. Now he's saying, doesn't it seem natural for a woman to cover her head? Or that she has long hair and that she should cover her head? Because in God's sight, her glory shouldn't be present, right? I mean, doesn't that make sense? It's not something that you should pull out of context and say, well, it doesn't make sense to me. Because he's argued this whole point up to this point, you know, three or four different reasons up to now. He's not saying to ignore everything and to just say, oh, I don't agree with it. That's not what he's saying. It's a rhetorical question. It's part of his argument, her persuasive part of his argument. So verse 14 and 15. Does not nature itself teach that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. For her hair is given to her for a covering. Now we have three different distinct questions. These are also part of his rhetorical questions. That through nature, we see that generally, and we talked about this a few minutes ago, generally speaking, men have shorter hair. Generally speaking, women have longer hair. There always will be generalities or exceptions to the generalities that, oh, well, there's some women who have really, really short hair because whatever, okay? But generally speaking, the norms have been women have longer hair, men have shorter hair. And let's go through each one of these questions. So number one is, doesn't nature itself teach that a man has long hair? That if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace for him, but if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. Usually when I think of men with long hair that wear it out like it's like a woman wears her hair, I think that's what Paul is saying. If you wear your hair like a woman wears her hair, I think of hippies. Generally speaking, I think of hippies. And I think of that Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, Almost Cut My Hair. And the whole song is about basically rebelling against society. Almost cut my hair, happened just the other day. It's getting kind of long, I could have said it was in my way. But I didn't, and I wonder why, and now I'm going to let my freak flag fly. Those are the lyrics to the song. David Crosby wrote it. I love his voice. Weirdo, but I love his voice, and he's a druggie. But he had a great voice, and this song is all about letting his freak flag fly in the face of culture. He's a hippie. He's an old burnout hippie, druggie, right? His hair to him represents a flag, a symbol of rebellion. You watch Woodstock, that old Woodstock, all these hippie guys that try to look like women, and to me, that's my gut reaction, is that when I see someone who's trying to act like the other gender, or at least have their hair like the other gender, to me, it smacks of rebellion, which is the exact opposite of submitting. That's my that's the nature that I see. That might not be your nature that you see. Now, in the other way, this might be more accurate in your perspective if you don't agree with me on the last one. When you see a woman, men, when you see women and you're like explaining some girl that you met to your friend, the first question is, what does she look like? Well, she has blonde hair. She's a brunette. She's a redhead. The first thing that we comment on is her hair. Usually, the first thing that we comment on to our buddies about a woman is her hair. Here's another question. How long do you spend on your hair, men, in the morning? You know, you're good, right? How long do women spend on their hair? How much time do you spend on your hair? How much money do you spend on products for your hair? I'm not chastising you. This is natural. Women tend to put lots of energy into their hair because it's beautiful. It's part of their glory. It's part of their beauty. It's not uncommon or unnatural for women to have longer hair that's beautiful. That's what we come to expect. And I think what Paul is saying isn't necessarily the length. If he was legalistic about this, he'd say, you know, grab the rulers or whatever, and I don't know what measurement they used back then, but he didn't mention any measurements. All he said was, isn't it natural that women have hair like this, men have hair like that? That's not a legalistic thing, that's a natural thing. Naturally, women usually have really nice, beautiful hair. And that's the thing that men noticed first. Oh, she's a brunette, or she's a redhead, or she's a blonde. You know, that's how we describe women, is through their hair color, their hair. Let's go to verse 16, and then we'll kind of hopefully wrap this up. Verse 16, if anyone intends to quarrel about this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. Paul makes it very clear that this was the custom of all of the churches of God at this point. And if you look at church history, the paintings, the artwork, any of the documentation, including books that were not published in the Bible, but there were history books of that time, or even letters from Paul or whoever else at that time, there's ample evidence that the church of Corinth was not the only church wearing head coverings, or not, you know, men not and women wearing head coverings. So to say that it only happened in the church of Corinth is historically inaccurate. Paul kind of brings this up. He says, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. The other churches practice this too. So if anyone intends to quarrel about this, we have no other practice. So this is the custom at all of the churches at this time, or at least all of them that they have documentation to say one way or the other. This wasn't just a practice in Corinth. There should be unity on this issue, I think, is what Paul is saying. If there was unity in the issue at that point in time, regardless of location and culture of the area that they lived in, there should be unity within us. I'm not saying that everybody agrees on it, but there should be unity. The other part of this statement that is clear is that the act of quarreling is not to be practiced. If you don't agree with this, that's awesome. If you agree with this, that's awesome. Don't fight over it. There is no quarreling. If anyone intends to quarrel about this, shame on you, is what he's saying. Don't quarrel. It's not good. It's bad. Okay, so the four reasons that Paul gives us for this head covering or non-head covering is authority and submission is the first one, which is found in the first few verses. Order of and creation, which is found in the next few verses. Distinguishing genders, men have shorter hair generally, women have longer hair generally. So distinguishing gender. And the last one is angels. So those are the four reasons. To me, I don't see any culture in any of those four reasons. But I'm going to give you the other argument right now. And then I'm going to tell you why I believe or disagree with it. The other argument has to do with culture. And there have been a couple of factors that have given creed to this idea that it's culture. So the one overarching argument that it is used against this practice is that it was cultural to that specific time or place. Now, you can't argue that it was just that place, because there's other churches that practiced it, so that argument's thrown right out. The other option, the other argument that I would say that doesn't make sense, or the reason why this doesn't make sense, is because the Corinthian culture didn't practice this. It was a completely new thing, like we talked about. The men would cover their head with togas in Rome. This is completely different teaching. The other part of this argument that doesn't show... This is the main argument that I hear. At the time in Corinth, there were temple harlots. And the temple harlots had shorter hair, and they were always uncovered. And it wasn't just their head that was uncovered, but a lot of their body that was uncovered, because they were prostitutes. They're harlots. And they're in the temple, and they're dancing around naked or semi-naked and trying to sexually arouse whatever's going on. This was all to pagan gods, right? And so when Paul says that a woman should cover her head, it's because he's contrasting with what was going on in the temple with the harlots and the temple harlotry that was going on within the pagan religions. Now, this is a very compelling argument. The only problem with this argument is that the temple harlots, the evidence that would support that was happening under Greek Corinth, not Roman Corinth, which was Greek Corinth was 300 or 400 years, you know, a few hundred years before Rome and took over Corinth. So when Paul wrote this, it was under Rome's leadership. There weren't even the same people there. I mean, it was hundreds of years later. There might have been some of the same descendants, but at this point, the culture is completely different because Rome was taken over. So the argument that the temple harlotry and all this stuff is very compelling, but when you look into the argument itself, it seems to be that they're taking the example from hundreds of years before and trying to apply it to the time of Paul. And with Paul not mentioning that specific point, it makes me think that it's probably not a very legitimate argument. I could be completely 100% wrong, and you might find evidence tonight to disprove me, and tomorrow and next week I'll come up and say I was wrong. But at this point, I don't see any good arguments to say that the temple harlotry was of that time period. Now I'm going to go through a 2-minute little brief summary of the head covering, the history of the head covering. From the time that Paul wrote this until about 1940s, 1950s, every church practiced this. Hats, mantillas, veils, bonnets. You can go through the history to find the styles. But every church, mainstream church I should say, practiced this up until 80, you know, 50, 60, 80 years ago. Grandma, am I right? Okay. At this point, until the 1950s, 40s, 50s, 60s is when it started to become a question. Everyone knew what it symbolized, or at least it wasn't shocking to walk into a church and see it. They might not have known what it meant, but when they saw it, it wasn't like a, what is that? You know, like nowadays, people walk in and they go, she's weird. What is that? Yeah. Back then, they just kind of assumed that even non-Christians would come into a church and take their hats off or put their hats on. Okay? It was just part of the expectation. You can see it in art, you can see it in the books, you can see it in the movies, you can see it in every form of historical documentation. It's there. Every major theologian throughout history taught in favor of this practice. Martin Luther, John Knox, John Calvin, Charles Spurgeon, Matthew Henry, Harry Ironside, Charles Ryrie. Those are just the ones I could find with a 2-minute search. There are thousands of theologians that all said the same thing. Rejection of head coverings in society seems to coincide with the rejection of authority and submission, both to males and to biblical religious teachings. It was only at the time that we started to hear the cultural arguments that this became an issue. Gender roles and sexuality is a big issue in our society today. Sexual identity is from God. We are to enjoy who we are and not try to mimic the other gender. I don't necessarily think that the head covering is the issue. It is the issue, and I mean, Paul is bringing it up as this is how it's played out. But I think the overall issues that he's arguing are the issue. At this point, gender roles have become so messed up. People are of weird sexual orientations, which are, you know, they're not new. They've been around for a long time. They're in the Bible. They're not, you know. But there's so many problems in society that seem to coincide with when this all happened. This topic is not widely taught or understood in the Christian realm of the United States right now, or in any of the really Western Europe nations. Most Christians haven't read this text or haven't studied it. And most who have dismissed it as cultural, most who have studied it have dismissed it as cultural. The head covering ultimately is a choice. Just like breaking your bread and baptism, we are not requiring it to be a part of this church, obviously. When someone walks into the church, they need to feel love, regardless of how they practice or not practice this. When we have those coming in from outside this gathering, they probably won't have ever heard of this text. That's the truth. We might not all agree. It says don't quarrel. Okay, love each other. Love each other. If you don't believe that this is for us today, or if you believe that that the text is saying something completely different than what I'm saying, than what how I've explained it, then don't practice it. If you're going to do it just because I tell you to do it, don't do that. If you feel like this is saying something completely 180 degrees from what I'm saying, don't do it. Or if you believe that it was cultural, don't do it. If you believe that it is a Christian tradition that was originated in Christianity, and that you believe that Paul wrote this with the idea that it would be for everyone, because 1 Corinthians talks about, when you read the introduction, it's to basically everyone who calls on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. It's not just to the church in Corinth. But if you believe what Paul is saying, and you believe that it should be, at least the way I've explained it, and you believe that it should be for today, then you need to do it. How you do it and when you do it is your own thing. But if you feel convicted to do it, do it. If you don't, don't. It's definitely counterculture. It doesn't go along with what the world teaches us, but most of Jesus' teaching doesn't go along with what the world teaches us, does it? Okay, so the point to remember is that this leads us back to headship. Okay? The head covering leads us is a symbol to headship. And one of the things, I kind of want to wrap up the whole symbols part of this with this. All three of the symbols that I've talked about so far have all led us back to Christ. When I see a woman that wears that has a head covering, it reminds me of Christ submitting. Not the will of himself, but the will of the Father. When I break the bread, I remember Christ's body being torn apart, speared, bleeding, broken on that cross for me. When I get baptized, which was a long time ago, well, 10 years ago, something, a while back, when I got baptized, it was to remind me about Christ's death, his burial, and his resurrection. All three of these lead us back to Christ. The symbols that we don't need to really worry about anymore, foot washing, I mean, that's legitimate. Maybe it's a good thing to do. Other symbols might be good things to do, but these are the three that lead us right back to Christ. They symbolize who Christ is, what he did for us. So I want you to consider all three of these symbols with how they lead you, remind you, and remind those around you of Christ. Because ultimately, the act of doing it doesn't matter. It's what they represent that matters. So all of these symbols lead us back to Christ, and he is who he is and what he did. Breaking bread, baptism, head covering. Now I want you to think about the ultimate act that Christ did that represented his submission to God. What was it? What was the ultimate sacrifice? The ultimate obedience. What was the ultimate sign of obedience? Anybody? He gave his life. I want to ask you this one question, and we'll close on that. Was there something on Christ's head when he died? Crown of thorns. In a sense, the crown of thorns is a symbol of his submission. Did he want to die on the cross? No. Was he willing to because the Father wanted him to? Yes. And when he walked that path with that cross, we don't know if it was like this one, like Val said. We don't know. It could have been close. It could have been completely different. But if you picture somebody hauling a cross bigger than this one, up a trail, up a mountain, up a hill, what was he wearing on his head again? Crown of thorns. Symbolizing his submission. Going through that. What he didn't want to go through, he did it anyway. So as we think about submitting to others, those who God has put in our lives, whether it's men submitting to Christ or women submitting to men, we need to remember that Christ is ultimately the one who submitted, that we are supposed to be mimicking. We are supposed to be mimicking him. And he didn't want to do it, but he did it. And all that time he had the thorn, the crown of thorns on his head. And ultimately, to me, when you see a crown of thorns, you think of submission. When I see it, when I see the cross, I think of what happened there. And sometimes they have a little crown of thorns up there. That reminds me that he didn't want to do that. He didn't have to do that. But he did it anyway. For me. All because the Father asked him and told him, "This is my will, that you go and die to buy back these people for me." So remember, while taking your hat off for men might be an inconvenience, that crown of thorns was a pretty big one. And throwing on something on your head, whether it be a hat or whatever you want to do, women, if you agree with this or not, whatever. If that's an inconvenience and you're called to do it, think about the inconvenience that Christ had to go through. I mean, that's horrible. So ultimately, it's if you can feel convicted to do it, do it. If you don't. And as a church, we're going to agree that this is probably an area of disagreement, but we're going to probably teach it from here on out as something that is relevant for today, but ultimately we practice grace. That's where I'm going to leave it. Van, would you pray for us? Thanks.